I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, are demographics really destiny for the GOP? A new analysis of the 2016 electorate offers warning signs to Republicans whose base continues to shrink, and there are red lights flashing Democrats' way as well. That's the piece in a recent Atlantic Magazine article written by Ronald Brownstein, who's with us the first part of this hour. He's Atlantic Media's editorial director for strategic partnerships. And then a little bit later in the hour, we'll be speaking with Whit Ayers, who is a GOP political consultant. And we'll speak with Margie Amaro, who is a Democratic pollster, about what they're looking at when it comes to getting more votes for the Democrats. And with the other guests, what will the changing demographics mean for Republican voters in this country in the years ahead. So it should be an interesting conversation. And we welcome you to join it whenever you'd like. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Ronald Brownstein is National Journal Group's editorial director. He is in charge of long-term editorial strategy. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist. And we thank you, Ronald, very much for being with us. Hi.
Hey, happy to be here.
Yeah. You know, if we did one show, we did 50 shows last go around about how the Republicans are never going to be able to elect a president again until they start attracting more Hispanic voters, particularly. They're bound to lose. They're just not going to win anything.
Right.
And then they won. What happened?
Right. Well, I mean, Donald Trump showed a different path. I mean, very different from what Republicans were talking about after 2012. He squeezed the maximum possible advantage out of constituencies that are still, however, shrinking. Mm. And he was able to concentrate that, particularly in the Midwest, the five key states that really tipped the election, Pennsylvania, Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where the demographic changes that have transformed the rest of society have been less pronounced, although still are occurring, and he was able to squeeze out the victory. It is worth noting, though, that Donald Trump did, and what was required to do that was the best performance by any candidate in either party among white voters without a college education since Ronald Reagan in 1984. Ronald Reagan won 67% of non-college whites in 1984, and so did Donald Trump in 2016. When you look at it, though, at the overall picture, that performance allowed Ronald Reagan to get to 59% of the total vote in 1984. It got Donald Trump to 46%. So you can see the magnitude of the change that has occurred even against the backdrop of his victory.
And when it comes to Democratic turnout, it really there was just not a very strong candidate, it would appear to me, because the number of people who didn't vote, when you compare it to 2012, particularly African-American voters, and yeah. I'd like for you to talk about Wisconsin for a moment. I had not heard these numbers. We just, African-American votes in this state just weren't there for Hillary Clinton.
It collapsed, and of course there's going to be a debate about how much of that were some of the voter ID laws and so forth, and how much of that was a lack of enthusiasm mm-hmm. for the candidate. But yes, I mean, there are two, you know, if you look at what happened in 2016, there are warning lights for each party. I mean, the first for Republicans, as we've said, is that even in this election, even with a candidate as focused as Donald Trump was on articulating the priorities and the fears, the hopes and the fears of the white working class, they continue to decline as a share of the total vote, whether measured by the Census Bureau, which is what I was looking at, or earlier by the exit poll. And that is a trend that is going back to the 1980s and shows no sign of ever reversing. I mean, I think in every election, if you could not reverse it in this election, just the underlying demography is really the driver there. You have more people who are either voters of color or who are college educated, and we obviously have a big class divide in how we're voting now. So that's clearly worrisome for Republicans. What's worrisome for Democrats is that the evidence is pretty clear from 2016, especially these census numbers, that demographic change does not necessarily translate into electoral change. And the pace at which the electorate diversified significantly slowed down in 2016 and lagged behind the change in the eligible voting population, which had not happened before. And the reason for that was because turnout continued to be very disappointing among Hispanics. You know, despite all the provocation of Trump, Hispanic turnout was essentially flat, and it's basically vibrated, oscillated within a tiny range of a very poor 47% to 50% over the last four elections. And even more ominously, African American turnout significantly declined. It fell from 2012 to 2016, the census said, more than it's fallen in any single election since at least 1980. And you saw that particularly pronounced in a state like Wisconsin, mm-hmm. where it just cratered in 2016.
You also talk about having a strong message, which Donald Trump did, Hillary Clinton perhaps did not, and also a potential problem for Donald Trump. You have to live up to what your message is,
yes.
too, and for Hillary Clinton and for the Democrats, not much of a message. You say in the article, the message was, well, you shouldn't vote for Trump because he's a bad man, and Hillary Clinton is a nice person, and we're stronger together. A really uncompelling message, you write, not only for white non-college educated voters, but for blacks and Latinos as well. They're looking for changes as well.
Right. I think one clear, an interesting kind of conclusion from this data that analysts have reached, and I think when you have Whit Ayers on later and Margie, I think they will talk about this, is that the weak performance among non-college whites or working class white voters and the low turnout among African American and Hispanic voters may both really have the same root, which is that Clinton failed to deliver an economic message that convinced either group that voting for her would materially improve their lives. I mean, she relied heavily on a kind of a general sense that we are the party of tolerance and inclusion, which is powerful and which is why the Democrats are improving upscale and, for example, beat Trump so badly among college-educated whites in a state like Wisconsin. And that is an important part of their message, and by the way, is an important limiting, I think, factor on their ability to ever reclaim as much of the white working class mm-hmm. as they used to have. But it was clearly not enough. It was not enough for any group in this election. And, the question of how you restore broadly shared prosperity in an era when the median income has not increased since 2000, which I believe is the longest period in American history where it has not gone up, that is the challenge. Now, Trump, has to prove that he can make that better. I'm not sure he can, but I do think that many of these white working class communities will feel that he is fighting for them regardless of whether he delivers results. So I think peeling them away may not be as easy as Democrats hope, because I think many of those voters see him as fighting for them. Having said that, in the poll that came out today from the Quinnipiac University, his approval rating among college whites was down 20 points from his vote.
Goodness gracious.
Sorry, non-college whites. Was down 20 points from his
vote. Really?
So that is
that's
a significant,
significant
decline.
That sure is significant. And as you also say, if there are certain issues, everybody says health care is the number one issue. It's not Russia. It's health care. The House passed, you write, the Obamacare replacement opposition from 2/3 of minorities and college-educated whites, also a plurality of non-college-educated whites. You need to be really careful with that issue, or people are going to say, hey, you didn't do anything for my health care, and this has put me in horrible shape.
Not only didn't do anything, but made it worse, right? I mean, part of Trump, people say, well, was Trump just instinctual? Was he just kind of casting around? I always felt that Trump had a very clear vision of who he was talking to in his campaign, and that it was essentially non-college whites, non-urban whites, and older whites, all of whom who felt excluded, if not actively disrespected, by changes in the culture, demography, and importantly, the economy. And the reason I felt that it was targeted was because he not only kind of did the nationalism tropes of opposing immigration and trade, but he broke from traditional Republican orthodoxy to say, look, I am going to defend your health care. Mm-hmm. I am going to defend Medicare and Social Security, because the dirty secret is that all of those old, those kind of white constituencies are actually quite supportive of government as long as they believe it is benefiting them, in effect, people who work hard, people who they view as working hard. So that was a big part of Trump's appeal. Instead, what he did on healthcare was sign on to a much more conventional, small government, almost libertarian Paul Ryan vision of healthcare that is focused on reducing government spending, cutting taxes at the top, and rolling back government involvement in the healthcare industry. In all of the five states that tipped the election, the five Rust Belt states that tipped the election, which again were Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Iowa, and Pennsylvania, in all of those states, most of the people who gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act were whites without a college education. They were a majority of those against coverage. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, that is, and particularly the Medicaid expansion. I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, we've both been doing this a while. The thought that Medicaid has always been a whipping boy for Republicans who have viewed it as a welfare program for the poor. But President Obama, in the ACA, extended Medicaid eligibility up the income ladder into the working poor at a time when the Republican coalition was extending down the income ladder into the working poor. And as a result, you have people in, you know, states like Ohio and Wisconsin, you have many poor Republican voters, lower income working white families that are now either on the ACA or on Medicaid itself. And so it has made it much more complicated, I think, than they expected to roll this back. It's probably the biggest obstacle to passing the repeal. And that is just an indication of how the party's agenda is struggling to catch up with its changing coalition. And we could point to a lot of issues on the other side, by the way, where Democrats are struggling to adapt to the modern reality of a coalition that relies more on white-collar workers, white among whites, than blue-collar workers. I mean, Democrats are now a coalition of basically white-collar whites and many blue-collar non-whites is kind of the heart of the coalition. And the blue-collar white communities have become, you know, essentially 2-to-1 Republican.
Well, let's talk about the Hispanic vote, because that was supposed to be the vote that was going to win it for the Democrats. There was no way the Republicans could touch that. And in order to be a party that was going to win, they had to get Hispanic vote. In some states, like Arizona, the Hispanic vote was very good for the Democrats. In other states, the turnout wasn't as great. What happened with the Hispanic vote?
Yeah, no one has fully answered that. It has to be one of the biggest disappointments for Democrats. Certainly, you could have not had a candidate who was more confrontational or who, in theory, should have provoked more of a rush to the polls than Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. With everything he said about Judge Curiel or about rapists and murderers and, you know, the whole tenor and tone of his campaign. And yet, nationally, turnout was no higher. In fact, it was slightly lower than it was in 2012. You can point to the failures of Clinton to deliver more of a bread and butter economic message, but I think there are deeper problems here for Democrats. The only bright side was in a few of those targeted states in the Southwest, Arizona, Colorado, and Nevada, especially Arizona and Nevada, they did generate improvements in turnout. And this really goes to a core question for Democrats, not so much for 2020, but looking beyond, is that in the long run, in an era where you are seeing this increasing polarization by class and age, where Republicans are winning consistently now upwards of 60% of non-college whites on a national basis, upwards of 60% of whites over 45 on a national basis, is the road back to the White House from reclaiming states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Iowa? Or is the future more in the Sun Belt, where you have this millennial white-collar minority population base that more accurately kind of tracks their modern coalition? And that's places like Virginia and Colorado, which have basically already tipped in their direction. And then kind of a step behind, you have, you know, North Carolina, Arizona, and maybe Georgia. I mean, so is North Carolina, Arizona, and Georgia the future of the Democratic Party, or is it holding on to Wisconsin and Michigan? In 2020, I think, you know, clearly the Arizona and Georgia and North Carolina transition has not progressed far enough where Democrats can bank on that. And I think there's going to be a lot of focus on finding a candidate who can go back into union halls in Racine and, you know, win votes. But in the long run, given the underlying changes in electoral allegiance and the kind of the demographic change or lack of change in some of these Midwestern states, I do think the Sun Belt probably is more of the Democratic future than the Rust Belt.
Oh, that's interesting. How do you explain the female vote going for Donald Trump?
Well, the big thing there was the class divide, right? I mean, you know, people talk about women as a monolithic block, but it is far from. And the, you know, you have two big divides historically, single versus married, single more Democratic, married more Republican, and then college versus non-college. Hillary Clinton won college-educated white women. She didn't win them by as much as it looked like she could have before the James Comey letter, but she did win them and won over 50% of the vote among them, one of the best performances among Democrats among college white women in the last 30 years. She lost the election, I think. The single biggest reason she lost the election was because white women without a college education, working-class white women who used to be called in the 90s sometimes waitress moms, they prefer Donald Trump's by 27 points in the exit poll. And what's really significant is that historically Democrats had run – you know, why had Democrats held on to these five Rust Belt states – even though they were sinking nationally among these working class white voters. And the reason was because they ran significantly better. They in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan Iowa, they ran significantly better among working class white voters than they did elsewhere in the country. That differential significantly narrowed this time. And you saw Donald Trump really improve on the performance among working class whites more in the upper Midwest than he did in the South, where it was already so lopsided there wasn't much further to go. But he, I mean, if you ask me why he is president, the single biggest reason, and it'd be interesting to hear from your callers, you know, why, is because so many white women without a college degree in the Midwest voted for him.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, the biggest single surprise in the exit polls.
And the Democrats didn't even see it. They didn't even, she didn't even come to Wisconsin.
No. She didn't see it coming.
Right.
I mean, they did. You know, and I remember thinking, and I wrote my claim to fame for 2016 was writing a piece in late October, questioning why at that point Hillary Clinton had spent $180 million on television in North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio, none of which she needed to win in order to get 270, and $6 million in Michigan and Wisconsin, which she did need to win. And the flaw in this, what made this especially strange, was that they understood they were in trouble in Ohio and Iowa. But the thought that whatever problem they were having in working class, you know, non-urban, culturally conservative communities, that the virus somehow stopped at the state line, always seemed to me incredibly misguided or optimistic. Because essentially you're talking about the same people in Michigan and Wisconsin as you are in Ohio and Iowa. And ultimately they voted in a very similar manner. By the way, that erosion was sufficient. It extended even to young people. You know, if you look at her margins among millennials in 2016 in these Midwestern states, they declined significantly from where Obama was in 2012. And you have to attribute that, again, to kind of younger working-class white voters as well. She was even union households. 60% of non-college whites, roughly, in a union household voted for Trump, according to the exit poll. So he dominated every segment of working class white America. And I think the big question for Democrats in 2020 is, do they think, how much of that do they think they can reclaim, and how much of it do they simply have to go around? Is that a rock in the road? Is the way to beat him by unraveling his hold on those voters, or is it more by making further gains among the white collar voters who are growing and mobilizing more of the minorities and young people who didn't turn out in 2016?
Well, you also have to put in the equation, he's got a pretty problematic presidency going at the moment, too. It's who knows what's going to happen.
Well, as we said,
right?
His approval rate, his approval rating among those working class white voters, according to the Quinnipiac poll today, is down 20 points from where it was. You know, and I keep looking, I mean, people keep saying his base hasn't cracked at all, and I suppose there are elements of his base you can say that about, but if your approval rating is now 20 points below your vote among the group that is most important to your success, it's hard to say there are no cracks in the base.
Interesting. Let's take a couple calls for you, and then we'll let you go and talk to the pollsters.
Okay.
Gary in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Gary.
Hi. I'd like to make a few points before you jump in. I appreciate your guest. He seems very knowledgeable. First of all, I think the Democratic Party is making a mistake to assume that most progressives are all keen with no wall, unlimited immigration, open borders. I'm a progressive, never voted Republican, and I'm not real happy about that approach to the safety of the country.
Okay. Ronald, how did that figure into all these numbers?
Well, opposition to large-scale immigration, I think, is absolutely critical to Trump's success. But it is ultimately, on most of these questions, he's in the minority. On the wall, we consistently have two-thirds of the country invariably in polls saying they oppose it. On denying legal status to anyone here illegally, that's down to about a fifth. And I, you know, I've been writing on polls like that since I was at the LA Times in the early 1990s. That's been consistent for two decades. Again, the feeling is most intense on the other side, or there's the most support on the other side, among working class whites. And it kind of goes to this larger question I'm asking, which is I think the view in kind of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party is that with enough economic populism, if we are a strong enough anti-Wall Street, anti-trade party, we can win back all of these communities that have moved to the Republicans and then stampeded to Trump. And I question whether economic populism is sufficient to overcome all of the gulfs, and you know them, if you're doing the show, you know them better than I do, on a whole range of cultural issues that separate Democrats from many of these voters, whether it's transgender bathrooms or immigration or climate, which functions effectively as a social issue, whether economic populism can really overcome all of that, or at least how much it can. And you just heard, I think, in the call, one indication of you know, what pulls people in that direction.
Right. And we go to Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two main points. The first one, I think the Democrats are not viewing correctly, is as to why they lost, is a moral point, and that is that more and more Americans are becoming pro-life, and even though they see the Republicans as not being in their financial best interest, because at a moral point, they won't vote for them because of abortion.
All right, let's take that issue, Ronald.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. Look, I think culture, not class, has been and is even more so the key dividing line in American politics. In that, as we said, the Republican Party, both parties are now cross-class coalitions. I mean, the Republican Party, you have essentially half of Donald Trump's votes came from non-college whites, and then they kind of an upper income, amalgam to that. And Democrats depend on largely white-collar whites and lower and minority voters, many of whom are blue-collar or below the median income. And what unifies these coalitions more than their economic situation is their view, I believe, fundamentally on the cultural and demographic changes remaking America, now reinforced by the economic changes. So basically, you have a Republican coalition that is largely uneasy on all three fronts, what I've called a coalition of restoration, and a Democratic coalition that largely welcomes the way America is changing, and everything from family structure to kind of the look, the face of America, what I call a coalition of transformation. I think that's what it is. And so that is basically where our politics divides. And that's why, as I said, I mean, as you hear from this caller, why I think the idea that economic populism alone is going to reverse the what's the matter with Kansas problem has always seemed to me delusional. Because if you can ask what's the matter with Kansas, you can ask what's the matter with Silicon Valley, or what's the matter with Bergen County? Why are so many upper income people voting Democratic when Democrats will raise their taxes? And the answer is because that isn't the key issue they're voting on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ronald. You're a great speaker, and thanks for the article. It's fascinating.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Ronald Brownstein, Atlantic Media's editorial director for strategic partnerships, and the article in The Atlantic, Are Demographics Really Destiny for the GOP? A new analysis of the 2016 electorate offers warning signs to Republicans whose base continues to shrink, and there are red lights flashing Democrats' way. We're going to be speaking with a Republican pollster and with a Democratic pollster to talk about all of this as we continue here on the Ideas Network. All right, now we are joined by, we've heard what the Republicans need to hear and what the Democrats need to hear in order to be successful moving ahead. Now we'll hear from a Republican pollster and a Democratic pollster to talk about what they think needs to happen in each party. Whit Ayers is a Washington, D.C.-based GOP political consultant. He is the president and the founder of North Star Opinion Research. Whit, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it gives me an opportunity to say hello to my Aunt Margaret there in Milwaukee.
Aunt Margaret, and Margaret is my favorite name. I had an Aunt Margaret, too. That's great.
Well,
thanks,
I've got
Whit.
A wonderful Aunt Margaret there.
I hope she's listening. And Margie Amaro is also with us, a Democratic pollster and the executive vice president of Penn Schoen Berland Research. Margie, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Well, thanks for having me. I, too, actually, I'm Margaret, but I'm not Whit's aunt, so just to clarify that.
Oh, Margaret, this is your day. That's great. All right, let's start with the Republicans. Let's start with you, Whit. And our guest, Ronald, wrote in his piece in The Atlantic that the Republicans take a gamble by aligning the Republicans ever more closely with the hopes and fears of a volatile constituency that while still large, has been irreversibly shrinking for decades as a share of the total vote, and that's white working class, non-college educated voters. You taking a gamble? Does the strategy need to change, Whit?
Ron Brownstein has been writing brilliantly about these demographic trends for many years, mm-hmm. and of course he's exactly right. I mean, the percentage of the electorate that is white has been declining every single presidential election since Bill Clinton's reelection in 1996, and it declined again in 2016. Donald Trump managed to slip the demographic punch one last time, mm-hmm. not in the popular vote. I mean, his popular right. vote was closer to John McCain's in 2008. He got less than Mitt Romney got. But he managed by the slimmest of margins to pull out an electoral vote win, only the fourth time in 58 elections that the loser of the popular vote won the electoral college. And Wisconsin was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the Democrats, one of the messages that he was saying was that the Democrats this time around just suffered from declining numbers, particularly among African Americans, where in the state of Wisconsin, where we are, the numbers were atrocious in terms of turnout, that maybe there was a real problem with identity politics, trying to please minority voters and LGBTQ people, and instead of having an overarching kind of message. Do you think that's a problem for the Democrats, Margie?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there. And look, when you have a race that ultimately was pretty close in terms of total numbers of ballots cast, there are lots of things that you can say, well, maybe it's this or maybe it's that. And the truth of the matter is you had an election where people felt pretty unhappy about both candidates as they headed into Election Day. I think it's unfair to and not really accurate to really blame one particular part of our Democratic base for the outcome. I do think that what we have, and I think Whit has said this himself, you had a very unique situation in Donald Trump and his celebrity power that made parts of the Republican base enthusiastic in the way that they're not necessarily always enthusiastic about their candidate. And it has revealed, I think, a fracture in the Republican orthodoxy, or at least in what it means to be a Republican or a conservative, in a way that is tumultuous for everybody, not just for the Republican Party, but for Democrats and independents. And, you know, now we're seeing the whole world is in part destabilized by this. So I wouldn't point the finger at any one particular group of voters. I think it's incumbent on Democrats. It's incumbent on anyone running for office. And it's incumbent, frankly, among the president, who doesn't seem to be taking the opportunity that comes with the office, to really try to develop a message that is inclusive, and it is also arms wide open and makes everybody feel that they're a part of that message. And that includes people of color. It includes women. It includes the LGBT community. It includes the white working class. All those groups need to feel that they have candidates and leaders who are speaking to them. And it's a shame that people don't feel that way currently. And people are right to not feel that way when they hear what's coming out of the White House.
Mm. And let's talk about what's happening with some of the Trump diehard voters, the people who fit that white working class, non-college educated. I didn't realize Ron was telling us during the first half hour that Donald Trump has lost the support of that key constituency for him. Numbers are down 20%. What does that make you think as a pollster, Whit?
Well, I think that he has had a very bad several weeks ever since he fired Director Comey of the FBI, and that's caused his job approval to slip. But overall, if you look at an average of polls, it's still holding pretty close to 40%. And that's, I think, a function of the fact that we haven't learned much new about Donald Trump, about his temperament, his knowledge base, his personality, his leadership style, that wasn't patently obvious in the year and a half before he got elected. I think the people who voted for Donald Trump did so with their eyes wide open. They knew what they were getting, and they simply felt like the need to change Washington was so great that they were willing to take a chance on him. And the numbers that Ron Brownstein was talking about among blue-collar whites are really stunning. I mean, they're in Juneau County in Wisconsin. Barack Obama won that county by 7 percentage points in 2012, 53-46. Donald Trump won that county 61-35.
That's amazing.
By 26 percentage points. It's a 33-point turnaround. And it's counties like Juneau County, Wisconsin, all over the Rust Belt that put Donald Trump in the White House.
And what about the Democrats? Was there a problem? The other thing that I think could have happened to the there could have been a possibility of a Bernie Sanders nomination. It would have been problematic for the party. But we were in uncharted territory, it seems to me, at least in my political memory in the last election, that what the Democrats failed to do was to look at, as Ron was talking about, this economic angst that people have been feeling ever since the year 2000, that people are worried about their jobs. They're worried they're not making enough money. And the Democrats just missed that. Did they miss that, Margie?
I don't think they missed it. I think it was clear. I think it was, you know, it wasn't that people didn't feel it. I think it was a little bit harder in the, you know, given the candidates that we had, to not see Trump as a candidate who was going to make some kind of change. I have a podcast every week, the pollsters, and we had both Trump and Clinton's pollsters on right after the election, and they both said they had a question in their tracking that asked something to the effect of, Do you think Donald Trump is going to bring change or more of the same? And then a follow-up question, like, is that good change or is that bad change? And I think that's the gamble that a lot of people took, that they felt, well, he is going to bring some sort of change that just may, you know, I don't know what kind of change it's going to be. It's a little unpredictable, but we need some sort of change. You know, the one thing that I would point people to who want to think about this economic driver a little bit more, there was a really interesting study done by a group called PRRI, and I think it might have been done in conjunction with The Atlantic, I don't know if Ron spoke to it, where they looked at a variety of different drivers or things that predicted whether or not folks in the so-called white working class were going to be Trump voters. And obviously party ID makes a difference, and to some extent views on immigration make a difference. But there was also the sense of economic fatalism, the fact that people who were worried that having a college degree wasn't really going to help them, that there was really kind of no hope for them to move and be upwardly mobile in terms of their personal financial situation. That was a driver of whether or not people were going to be Trump voters, but not necessarily feeling like your economic finances were hard, that your personal financial situation was tough, just feeling not caught up, that you were falling behind, that actually predicted whether or not you were going to be a Clinton voter. It was the pessimism about it that predicted whether or not you were going to be a Trump voter.
Let's talk a little bit about satisfaction with and problems that you see as a pollster with for Republicans who may be running from midterm reelection in midterm. I noticed the president today was on infrastructure, which I think he should have talked about a long time ago before this whole Russia thing started, because now that's going to be omnipresent. And it seems as though he had a message that would resonate with a whole lot of people who are looking for work, who want good paychecks each week or however often they're giving them. And yet, the message he was giving in Cincinnati is sort of drowned out by this whole thing that's happening with investigation after investigation. And any chance, maybe you think I'm wrong, of bipartisan taking on this issue is kind of out the window. So a couple questions. Do you think that's true? And two, what does all that's going on now portend for midterms for Republicans? How would you message, and will they stay with Donald Trump candidates?
You know, Kathleen, one of the things that Donald Trump did toward the very end of the campaign for president was stick to his teleprompter and get off Twitter. I think that's one of the reasons why he managed to eke out a win in the election. He has not seemed to be able to stick to that discipline of late, and he has fed his political enemies ammunition every single day with yet another series of tweets. If he could get off his Twitter account and stick to his teleprompter and drive a consistent message, I still think there's plenty of opportunity for him to accomplish some things, maybe even with infrastructure, with some Democratic support. But he can't do it if he's constantly feeding the latest scandals and the media is focused on the scandals. As far as what it means for midterms, we don't know a whole lot about what will happen a year and a half from now, because I'm not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. But we do know that midterm electorates are older, whiter, more conservative, and more Republican. And that obviously favors Republicans. We know that the Senate map strongly favors Republicans, overwhelmingly favors Republicans. So the Republicans are likely to hang on to the Senate. But we also know that the president's party almost always loses seats in midterm elections. 35 of the last 38 midterm elections in the House. Since the Civil War, the president's party has lost seats, and we know that angry and disaffected voters turn out at higher rates in midterm elections, and that obviously helps Democrats at the moment. So it's really a tough call. We do know that there are 23 Republican-held seats that Hillary Clinton won, and it takes 24 seats for the Democrats to take control of the House. So the House is definitely going to be in play much more than the Senate, and it's anybody's guess right now who pulls it out.
Interesting. Margie, what do you say to that? How do Democrats win in midterms?
Well, Whit has a lot of, he's got a good sense of the lay of the land. I would say, one of the things that's a little bit harder to measure or capture this far out is the candidate recruitment and the incredible energy on the Democratic side to run for office across the board. You have 11,000 women who are running for office in offices all around the country. You have, many, many seats of all the congressional seats that are in play that have multiple strong candidates, people who did not think they were ever going to run for office, who said, you know what, this is just out of hand. I'm running. I'm going to do it. I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. And it's harder to have kind of a stat on that, but it is for sure something that is really sweeping the country, even in districts that would not necessarily be in play, haven't had a competitive race in a while, have Democrats lining up because there's so much outrage. You also see the lack of crossover appeal for Trump, the lack of a honeymoon, the lack of, any kind of, support for Trump among Democrats, and in a way that is not very typical for Democrats. Democrats are very united on a variety of issues. They're united in their, animosity or hostility toward Trump or the rejection of Trump's policies. You see an issue climate where Republicans are losing some of the advantage. Pew's shown this over Democrats on, who do you trust more on a variety of issues. Democratic identification is strong relative to Republican identification as a percentage of people who say they're a D or an R, what jersey they're wearing currently. It basically, however you look at it, you see more enthusiasm on the Democratic side. Now, will that translate to enough votes to make a real change in one of the chambers? That's still an open question. You also have a lot of governor's races in play this election cycle, too, all around the country. That plays a role. It plays a role in redistricting. The next time around, there is a lot at stake, at least currently, the current climate is Democrats are really engaged because there's so much really at threat that Democrats are waking up every day trying to figure out how they can best protect it.
Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start with Gloria in Madison. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. Very interesting program. I have a quick comment and a question. The comment is about Trump. A lot of people said they voted for him or would vote for him because he's a businessman and he could bring his business acumen to, being president. And I think that may be a place where they're losing confidence because there doesn't seem to be good organization. So that's my comment. My question is, in all these polls and whatever, it seems to me I never see anything about voter suppression, what effect that had. And especially here in Wisconsin, I'm very concerned that if you look at the black vote in Milwaukee being way down and some of these others, I registered people and I worked the polls and I also canvassed. And I would like to know really what effect that had on the populations that the Democrats counted on helping them out.
All right. Well, let's hear from Whit on that first. I know he's a Republican, but I'm interested in his thoughts. And then we will go to Margie. Whit, what do you think?
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton simply did not energize Minority voters, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, their turnout was all down across the board. And I think the reason was that Barack Obama energized them and Hillary Clinton didn't. I think that's far more of the explanation for why minority turnout fell off. Rather than voter suppression. It's very difficult to identify specific areas where where requirements for things like photo ID actually suppress the vote. In fact, after Georgia adopted photo ID for voting, minority participation actually went up. So I think it's more a matter of lack of energy and lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton than it is any voter suppression that occurred.
Margie?
Well, I would, you know, Gloria, you sound like you're well-informed on this. I would look at some of the work by Ari Berman, who is one of the national experts on vote suppression and voter ID laws, has an article very recently in The Nation about Wisconsin specifically suggesting that the ID law suppressed hundreds of thousands of votes in just in Wisconsin, which could have very well tipped the scales to Trump. Now, you know, that doesn't mean that Trump didn't have support with an enthusiastic support with folks that he did, or that Clinton couldn't have done better with some groups, not just in Wisconsin but around the country. All those things can all be true at the same time. I think that's a separate issue from whether the polls can capture that, because sometimes the polls are not this sensitive enough in any state to be able to capture that kind of pattern beneath the surface. And then the other issue is, how does that play as a vote driver or as a way to think about what party you know, with whom you share your values, the concerns about vote suppression? I think, you know, it's still an issue that is mobilizing for the bases of both parties more than for swing voters or for voters overall. But these actions that are not unique to this election or to Wisconsin are the kinds of things that make a lot of people of color feel not welcome in the Republican Party.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We have two guests with us this half hour, and they are Margie Amaro, Democratic pollster, Executive Vice President of Penshone Berlin Research, Whit Ayers, D.C.-based Republican political consultant, president and founder of North Star Opinion Research. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network. Facebook comment, Dick on Facebook says this, how Democrats can reclaim working class voters, run someone like Sanders instead of Clinton. The working class is tired of corporatist parasites. And what do you think of that? Margie, I guess that goes to you first.
Well, my husband actually worked on the Sanders campaign and was the guy behind ads like the America ad, so he'll be happy to hear that comment. I would say that, you know, I think that the issue of, ties to Wall Street and corporate interests was a factor in the primary. I think in terms of the differences between Trump and Clinton, I mean, if you look at, you know, who Trump has surrounded himself with, who, you know, the kinds of policies he's been fighting for versus the kinds of policies and people that Clinton would have fought for or surrounded herself with, I mean, there's really no comparison. There's really no way to put them in the same league, given how much more focused Trump is on protecting the status quo with, you know, folks who are part of his donor base.
Wait, do you think Bernie Sanders would have beat Donald Trump?
No. No, I don't. And I think if the nominees had been Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, would have run and would have been very, very competitive. As a Republican, I certainly hope that the Democrats go the route of Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist and wasn't even a Democrat, because that's not where most voters are. Most voters are in the middle, and there's not really anyone to speak for them at the moment. I don't think that's the way to resurrection for the Democrats.
So where do you put Donald Trump on the political spectrum? Is he in the middle?
He is his sui generis. He is a unique
brand, all his own.
And so I don't put him anywhere on the spectrum other than that he is Donald Trump.
Let's go to Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. It with all due respect, I disagree wholeheartedly with your Republican strategist, because Bernie Sanders, I saw speak in person 4 times, and I can tell you that man's message resounded with millions of people, and in Wisconsin won the primary in 70 of 72 counties. And I also know that a lot of people that wanted to vote for Bernie in the general election voted for Trump. And I think Trump saw that Bernie's message was resounding and kind of stole parts of it. I'm for the little guy. Yeah, right, Donald. And that's, people fell for it. And the voter repression is another issue. Yeah. Thousands of people in, it was either North or South Carolina, went to vote and their name was off the voter registration list. So they couldn't vote.
All right, thanks, Claire. Witt, you want to start?
I just would like to say that winning a primary, a Democratic primary that tends to draw the most liberal element of a population, tells you nothing about the ability to win a state in a general election.
Mm. You know, you talked about Bernie being a Democratic socialist. What do both of you think about, we may be entering a new time here where these party labels are turning out to be kind of an albatross. The country doesn't seem to be able to move past excessive partisanship, that maybe the time is long gone for these political parties, and it is time for independent thinkers and people who really do want to address the concerns of Americans to push through the structure we've had for a long time. Now, I didn't think I'd say that, but I'm wondering now if things aren't in such upheaval that indeed the parties may become less meaningful.
Well, Kathleen, you put your finger on a very important point, which is that the polarization of the country, the Republicans turning hard to the right and the Democrats turning hard to the left, makes it far more difficult to actually get anything done. We still have a political structure that has a strong bias toward two political parties. And the real question, I think, in the wake of the Trump era is whether we're going to have some sort of realignment of the two coalitions so that the Republican and Democratic parties 10 years from now don't look anything like they do today. But that remains to be seen.
Margie, what do you think?
I mean, we have a lot of competing challenges right now in our political dialogue. And the fact that you have fewer people identifying with one party and a rise in people who identify as independents is a challenge for both parties, to be sure. Another challenge at the same time is you have such an incredible partisan divide on every single issue. That wasn't true when I entered this business 20 years ago. But now you basically can't look at any number for what overall Americans think, because it's almost meaningless, because you really, the divisions by party are so massive that everything needs to be examined by party, because they're basically, on every question, voters are the polar opposite of each other, of the two parties. So you also have an increase in number of people who say they don't want, they don't know anybody of the other party, or they don't trust people of the other party. They don't want their children to marry into the other party. They don't have a lot of friends who voted for the other candidate.
Right, right.
That kind of pattern where we are sorting ourselves geographically and socially, I mean, just in terms of where people live, I mean, that's not any candidate's fault. That's just an American phenomenon. But you have all those things happening simultaneously, in addition to this, very corrosive divide in Washington that has structural causes, not just ideological causes. It is causing a lot of volatility, and I worry a lot about how we get back from there.
Yeah, I think we all do. Well, thank you very much to both of you. It was a really good half hour, and I hope you'll join us again. Margie Amaro, thank you so much, and Whit Ayers, thank you. And this is our Margaret Day. Here's to Aunt Margaret in Milwaukee. And, I have to ask you this, because I'm going to get a puppy. I lost my dog a couple weeks ago, and I want to get a female dog, and I had an Aunt Margaret. And Margaret really is my favorite female name. Would it be offensive to a human who's named Margaret to have me name my dog Margaret?
Not to me.
It wouldn't
be okay with me.
Okay. It's okay.
I sign off on it. Totally
oh, good. Good. Okay. Margaret, it is. I like that. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, our thanks. And our thanks also to Ron Brownstein, National Journal Group's editorial director, for the wonderful piece that he wrote in The Atlantic, which will be on our Facebook page, by the way. Just a reminder, tomorrow we have, I know everybody's going to be watching this and listening to it, but we will have, so you can listen to former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence tomorrow. It starts at 9 o'clock in the morning. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this interesting hour and for on-air production as well. And thanks, everybody, for your interest and for all of your calls. Until mañana.